Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us, we have Irene Elgenzia, who is Professor Emerita in the Department of Political Science at Boston University. She's here to talk about her new book, Dying to Forget, Oil, Power, Palestine, and the Foundations of U.S. Policy in the Middle East, published in 2015 by Columbia University Press. Thanks very much for being with us on the program today, Irene.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
So just to start off, could you tell us how you came to write this book?
Well, you know, I have an ongoing interest in U.S. foreign policy and working in U.S. archives. I had published some years ago a book called Notes from the Minefield, U.S. Intervention in Lebanon and the Middle East in 1958. And I found that a very, very compelling adventure, and the ease of access of archival sources here, and the new findings made me think that it might be useful to look at 1948. Of course, the events of 48 have been and are permanently on the agenda. It's a the subject of Israel and Palestine is understandably one of constant interest, and the possibility of reconsidering, discovering whether or not there was new U.S. material that had, or U.S. material that had not previously been examined, was very, very tempting for me. So I'm a long-term student of history, and there are many, many reasons why this would be an important subject, but that might give people a clue.
Great. So just to set the scene for talking about the main arguments and themes of your book, can you tell us a bit about what has been the dominant interpretation of U.S. policy in the Middle East, particularly in the period that you look at, which is the late 40s, and begin to tell us a bit about how your book challenges that interpretation?
Yes. Well, now I'm looking specifically at the emergence of the Israel-Palestine conflict. And there is, of course, a substantial literature on the conflict. There is less than you might think on the U.S. role. But there are two factors that, or three perhaps, that are important, or that have been traditionally dominant in interpretations of the subject. One, of course, is the Cold War. The beginnings and the manifestations of U.S.-Soviet tensions in the area of the Eastern Mediterranean and the oil-producing areas of the Middle East, which were of enormous importance to the U.S. in the post-war period. So the second, I would say, emphasis, but it is perhaps more my emphasis than that of many others, is the role of oil in the construction of U.S. policy in this period. Now, with respect to U.S. policy in Palestine and Israel, many students of the Truman administration argue that he was himself a religious man. He was very moved not only by the events of the Holocaust, but by his own study of the Bible, and was very much persuaded, many people argued, by the common values of the new state of Israel and the U.S., and for that reason pursued a number of different policies. So the first looks at the question of the Cold War. The second looks at the issue of oil. The third looks at the search for allies, common values, and the extent to which Israel fits that. Now, my own work, I argue that the U.S. evidence that I have found indicates that oil was the dominant concern of the U.S. after 1945, that is to say, the future of U.S. oil company holdings in the area of Saudi Arabia in particular, where what became Aramco in 1947 was operating. And the concern for the role of oil in national defense and foreign policy is very, very clear in the secondary literature on the post-war period and in the primary sources of the U.S. as well. So I didn't find that to be particularly controversial. What surprised me and what I think surprised many readers as well was the extent to which the issue of oil figures in the policy towards Palestine. That's a connection that hasn't really been made, I think, as closely. While I'm sympathetic to the question of values, I don't think that it was a determining factor. The role of the Holocaust, which is one of the questions you want to turn to in a moment, yes, this is a factor in the molding of policy in this particular area.
Okay. Well, I think we'll return to looking at oil in particular, but yeah, maybe if we can go on and talk about how important the impact of the Holocaust was, and particularly the issue of post-war European Jewish refugees in shaping U.S. policy.
Good. I think both are very important. The first, of course, in a very general way. I mean, conditions that the U.S. Found, knew about, intervened in the Europe post-1945 were very much marked by the Holocaust and the European refugee problem, including the Jewish refugee problem. On that issue, I found, by the way, something called the Harrison Report that you might be interested in June 1945. President Truman decided, after he had come back from Potsdam, he decided to investigate conditions of the displaced persons in Europe, and particularly those survivors of the war who were the American zone of occupation in Germany. The result was he appointed Earl Harrison, who was a professor of law at UPenn, to head a commission to go and investigate conditions in that area. And Harrison came back with a report that was very harsh in terms of the conditions in which under which refugees were kept, to the surprise of Truman, to the shock of Eisenhower, who was ultimately in charge of the region. But Harrison also came back with many ideas about what was necessary. The prime issue, of course, was to improve the conditions, the living conditions in these areas. But second to that was the desire of the refugees to go home, if that was possible, and if not, to find a place to go. And so you immediately get into questions which are very familiar today, the reluctance of states to accept refugees, including, you know, Western industrialized states, including the U.S., great reluctance to admit any significant number of refugees. Some did want to go to Palestine, and for many, Palestine became the way out in the absence of any other alternative. So, in fact, Truman, on concluding on his reading of the Harrison Report, got in touch with the British, who, of course, were the mandatory power in Palestine, and said to them, I'm recommending that you accept 100,000 Jewish refugees immediately. This was, for the British, whose policies Truman may not have known very much about, policies in Mandate Palestine, they rejected. So this led to a number of different things: Anglo-American Committee, the subsequent plan, Morrison Grady plan, the decision of the British to bring the Palestinian issue to the UN in 1945, eventually the creation of a special committee on Palestine. You know, one thing led to another. Eventually it led to the partition resolution of November 29, 47. But I think the Harrison Report is something which deserves a lot more attention than what it has been, you know, has generally been given. And it provides really a link and a connection with many of these issues that we're concerned about.
That's very interesting. So that in terms of Truman's response to the report, it was sort of partially humanitarian, but also partially a question of that the U.S. didn't necessarily want to be responsible for finding a place for these refugees, either in the U.S. or elsewhere.
Yeah. No, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think Truman's response was on several levels, certainly I would say on a humanitarian level. But also the refugee question was a question that was discussed within the Department of State and within the very, very small group of people concerned with Palestine. So, for example, one member of the policy planning staff by the name of Gordon Merriam wrote a report in which he presented the view that he repeated many times. The refugee question is an international question, and it should be solved internationally. I mean, again, that echoes today, right, for obvious reasons. Now, Truman was aware, he could not but have been aware of the racist, the nativist, the exclusivist views of those who opposed immigration reform in the U.S. Nonetheless, there were many who argued that even within existing constraints of immigration, there was room for more refugees to come. But the emphasis that Truman and those responsible for the emerging Palestine problem, the emphasis that they chose, or that they felt that they had no option but to choose to place, was on Palestine as an alternative. So there, they didn't. Nobody was talking about immigration restraints on immigration. That nobody that the U.S. felt was a significant voice. Of course, those in Palestine were concerned. Palestinians, other Arabs, did raise these same questions, but that didn't generate very much interest.
There's a common perception, particularly on the left, that U.S. foreign policy towards Israel has been overly influenced by an American Zionist lobby. Can you tell us what your research has found about this? What role did American Zionists play in shaping U.S. policy in the period that you're examining?
Look, I think this is a very important question. In my work, I would say that I downplay this because I didn't have sufficient evidence, in my view, to argue differently than what I did. We're not talking about a period that's comparable to the present, where you have as highly mobilized and effective a group. There's nothing comparable to AIPAC in the period of 1947-48. However, there was a mobilized, there was an organized group of American Zionists who were not all in agreement with some of the policies coming from Ben-Gurion and and the officials of the Jewish Agency in the U.S. That's a separate question. But there was collaboration. So, for example, when by January, February 1948, so this is several months after the partition resolution was passed, the UN partition resolution, that's 181, and it was passed November 29th, 1947. Between the fall of 47 and the winter of 48, it became clear to U.S. officials, and it became clear, of course, to those living in Palestine and to U.S. Officials on the ground, consuls, that there was an escalating violence as a result of the absence of any kind of a consensus, accord, meaningful consensus between Jews and Arabs. In Palestine, is insofar as the objectives of the Zionist movement were concerned. This awareness reached the point that by January, February 48, there was talk about rethinking the whole partition question and possibly bringing the issue of the conflict back to the UN and supporting trusteeship. Now, the fear of that is to say, the Zionist movement in Palestine, Ben-Gurion, the dominant party of that he headed of labor in this period, considered this very, 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 very ominous. And this is what resulted in the appointment of Eliyahu Epstein, director of the Jewish Agency political office in Washington, to get on the ball and to arrange to meet with our friends, as Yahoo Epstein wrote. Now, that decision to mobilize our friends was, of course, an appeal to what you might call the lobby, the Zionist movement in the U.S.
Mm.
Now, you're asking a specific question. What about their influence on policy? I find that, you see, in the context of the research that I've done, you know, we'll get to that in a moment, I find that problematic. In other words, I find it problematic to say the Zionist movement, the Zionist lobby, such as it was at the time, played the determining role. I'm not prepared to say that at all. Strong Zionist supporters had a very clear agenda in terms of the direction they wanted to move the Democratic and the Republican Party in, that they tried to influence Truman at the time, for example, of the presidential campaign in November of 48. This is accurate. This is true. Other people have written about this. But was this did this really determine the direction of U.S. decisions on the question of Palestine? I don't think so. But were U.S. officials aware of the importance of support for Zionist objectives in the U.S., in addition to being aware of the impact of the Holocaust on popular thinking in the U.S. about Palestine? Yes. So, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. So I guess you already touched on the role briefly of Eliyahu Epstein, but could you tell us a bit more about who he was, who Max Ball was,
right,
and what their relationship tells us about what you call the oil connection?
Right. Well, this is one of the, I think, most exciting findings of my work, and this potentially led in a new direction. Because, look, I should have said this earlier. You asked me what about interpretations of U.S. policy. Among commonplace U.S. interpretations, one was that the U.S. was antagonistic towards Zionism and opposed the creation of a Jewish state because U.S. officials were concerned about the impact this would have on U.S. access to oil in the Middle East. So what you had was a presentation of a view that, look, Washington faces a choice. Either you support guaranteed access to U.S. oil by pursuing policies that are perceived as befriending Arab regimes, or you support Zionist objectives, the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine, and you don't know what the results may be with respect to oil concessions. You might be facing the cancellation of such concessions. I found that this is a false choice, that in fact the U.S. was able by 48-49 to choose both to support its primary objective in the region was to support access and control by its own U.S. companies, private companies, Aramco, the major one, to assure that continued access and to support eventually the creation of a Jewish state. That these turned out not to be antagonistic. Now, one of the keys for me, there are two keys. One is, of course, the position of the Saudi government in this period, which was to clarify its stand before the U.S. and before its other Arab oil-producing states. And that stand was that the Saudi government made a distinction between commercial and political decisions of the U.S. So you had a U.S. administration with which it was in disagreement on political issues, but you had private U.S. corporations with which it was working in harmony. So once the distinction was made between commercial and political, you have a legitimacy then, right, of supporting the commercial interests that were enormously profitable, in a sense that neutralized potential Saudi opposition. But you have something else that happened here. So to go back to the story that I mentioned a few seconds ago. So Epstein, who had a prominent position, he's director of the Jewish Agency political office in Washington, one of two major, the other one was Chertok, I believe, the later Moshe Sharet, major representative of the Jewish Agency in the U.S. between 45 and 1948. He was able to meet Max Bohl in February of 48. Who was Max Bohl? He was the director. He's not part of the policymaking community, small as it is. He's outside of it. He was the director of the oil and gas division of the Department of the Interior. And he was considered by the chair of the special subcommittee investigating the role of petroleum in relation to the national defense in 1948 as one of the most knowledgeable people in the U.S. with respect to domestic and foreign sources of oil. He was in touch with the enormous network of committees, commissions, dealing with all problems related to petroleum, national interest, and national defense. It happened, I don't know how to describe that accident, but it turned out that his daughter married a young man who was a Palestinian of Jewish origin, who subsequently became the first director of Israel's oil company, Delek, Ray Kozlov. His daughter was Max Bohl's daughter, lived with Ray Kozlov, became the wife of Ray Kozlov. Kozlov requested Max Bohl, requested a favor of him. He asked him one day in February, would he be willing to meet a friend? The friend was Eliyahu Epstein. So that, sort of bizarre personal twist is, bizarre turn of events. Epstein and Bohl met, but what was unpredictable was the extent of the ease, let's say, of communication between them. Epstein was very, very clear as to what his interest was. He was upfront with Bohl about representing what he represented, the Jewish Agency. The Jewish Agency was very concerned with U.S. policy, and he specifically. Bohl asked him, what did he want? Why was he turning to Bohl? And the answer was he turned to Bohl because he knew of Bohl's role in oil policy and because he wanted to know from Bohl what the thinking of oil companies was with respect to partition. This is really going, what I say, this is a jugular vein. This is really the heart of the matter. And they didn't meet once. They met successively over a number of times in Washington. Bohl proposed that Epstein meet with U.S. oil executives. It didn't happen immediately, but there were meetings, and the meetings continued after 1948. That is to say, after Max Bohl eventually retired, he and his son, both were geologists, worked together, and they were invited by Ben-Gurion to come to Israel. They wrote the first law, the first petroleum policy for Israel. As I say, Kozlov became the director of the first Israel oil company, Delek, and question of fuel and the fuel access was and remained very important to Israel. So you have here a family connection with political implications that are vastly important. Now, how come this is so little known? So can I continue on this for a moment?
Yeah.
So in part, the answer is that, okay, you're dealing now with developments outside the conventional circle of policymakers, because Bohl was not part of that. On the other hand, if you know anything about U.S. policy at this period, you'll easily understand that the question of petroleum and access, as I mentioned, you know, as I've said repeatedly, could not be ignored by any of the people involved in devising policy. So there are two things. One, I would recommend to those who have an investigative instinct and who are curious to cast the net very, very wide. Ball is outside the framework, but he has influence in it. I mean, the sources, by the way, I use with respect to Ball are found in the Harry Truman Library. His papers are in the Harry Truman, H.S. Truman Presidential Library, and they are a gold mine. His connection with Epstein, by the way, is also discussed in Israeli state archives of the very same period. So part of the reason, I think, why Ball's role has been, ignored in this connection with Epstein is that he's outside of the conventional framework that people look at who are interested in policy. But the second thing is that we come back to this issue of oil. If you are, if you believe that it's important to narrowly define your objectives and you want to look for political objectives of policymakers and minimize the emphasis on the economic aspect, well, then that might be another reason why you would tend not to go in this direction. There is a lot of information, of course, on Epstein, and Israeli sources do recognize the important role that he played. He was one of a group of Arabists who, in fact, he became the first Israeli ambassador to the U.S. as well. So he's a known figure, but the combination is little known. Sorry, I've gone on so long on that.
Oh, no, that's all right. It's fascinating. So we might move on. If you could tell us a bit about how the 1948 Palestine War, or also known as the War of Independence, led to the creation of the Palestinian refugee problem.
Yes.
And then what Israel's approach was to this problem, and then in turn, how the U.S. responded to Israel's approach.
Right. Now, here again, I would say that this looking at this period is enormously important because most conventional accounts, mainstream accounts of U.S. policy in this period do recognize not only that the origin of the Palestine refugee problem is in exactly this period, that is to say, the period between the partition resolution, the creation of the state in 1948, and the period beyond 48. So we're talking about a brief period that resulted in the flight in or expulsion of the figure that's given in U.S. sources varies from 700 to some go as high as 850,000 and more. The CIA, by the way, recognized the refugee problem as beyond, in terms of numbers, beyond anything that had occurred during World War II. So the first thing that I want to say is that unlike some of my colleagues who have written about this, I place more emphasis on the U.S. discussion of the refugee problem. I find that it occupies a far more important place than I had known or reason to believe on the basis of what I read. By that I mean there was an awareness of the importance of the refugee issue for humanitarian and also for political reasons, the assessment that their presence would be potentially destabilizing not only for Palestine, but for the states in which Palestinian refugees subsequently went. Now, in Israel declared its independence May 14th, 1948, Washington followed with recognition, de facto recognition of the U.S. Of the new state, and U.S. officials of course, affirmed their recognition of Israeli sovereignty. Now, in July 48, so Philip Jessop, who was then, and I'm reading from a passage that I cited in my own book, he was acting U.S. representative at the UN, and he sent the Secretary of State at the time, who was Marshall, a statement of Israel's official position on the question of refugees. So this is how, this is the position that the U.S. conveyed to Washington with respect to Israel's view, and this is the statement. The government of Israel must disclaim any responsibility for the creation of this problem. The charge that these Arabs were forcibly driven out by Israel authorities is wholly false. On the contrary, everything possible was done to prevent an exodus, which was a direct result of the folly of the Arab states in organizing and launching a war of aggression against Israel. The impulse of the Arab civilian population to migrate from war areas to avoid being involved in hostilities was fostered by Arab leaders for political motives, and so on. That was the position that Washington understood to be the Israeli position, which was repeated on numerous occasions. It differed radically from that of the U.S., and so it's a theme that runs throughout my book, but particularly in the conclusion, I have what I call, in place of a conclusion, a discussion of discovery, denial, and deferral, three stages of the U.S. views of the place of the refugee problem, its implications for resolution of the conflict, and the decision, the shift in the U.S. position. So the U.S. position in fact, the summer of 48, was very, very strongly critical of Israel's expulsion of refugees and critical of conditions that led to refugee flight and supportive of repatriation. This is even before UN Resolution 194 of UN General Assembly Resolution 194, which called for the repatriation of Palestinian refugees, which the U.S. supported. I mean, what happened briefly was this, that by July 48, this is several months after Israel's emergence as an independent state, the U.S. State Department, the military became, in fact, were quite impressed by two things. One, what they saw as the very significant shift in the balance of power in the region as a result of Israel's emergence. Two, the effectiveness of its military. Three, the comparative strength of its military, such that they identified Israel as the second most important military force in the Middle East after Turkey. Now, this is impressive. And indeed, U.S. officials were very impressed by this. And by within a year of Israel's emergence, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and various elements of the U.S. military were thinking that Israel could potentially be an ally in the region for the U.S. This is not the beginning of what people call a special relationship. I'm making a much more modest statement, but I am suggesting that the origins of the U.S. relationship with Israel go to this period, 48-49. But as a result of this, there was a very deliberate, explicit decision, stop pressuring Israel on the refugee question. Stop pressuring Israel on the question of internationalization of Jerusalem. Stop pressuring Israel on the question of territorial expansion. Those three issues that U.S. officials then and later concede are at the core of the conflict, they were set aside in favor of what I call a policy of deferral. And the deferral was quite explicit. In other words, a decision was made if the U.S. to its officials, if you're going to recommend to Israel that it pursue any policy, if you're going to recommend any changes to Israeli policy, you have to obtain Israeli approval. So this is something to bear in mind when, at the present time, Vice President Biden goes to Israel and criticizes Israel with respect to settlements, the understanding is nothing's going to follow. There is no policy that's going to follow. It's just talk. But the origin of that shift is not an accident. It's a deliberate shift on the basis of calculations of interest.
We've taken up enough of your time today, but if you could tell us a little bit about what you're working on next briefly, that would be fantastic.
Obviously, the issue is not one that I have put aside. So, in fact, I'm continuing to collect information for what I hope will one day be a second edition on the significance of some of these issues and the addition of material that I didn't have a chance to include. But right. one of the questions that interests me, I'm sure interests you as well in a general way, how does one explain that information which is accessible, I'm using public sources, I'm not using anything that is impossible to find or which you need, you know, special permission, everything is declassified, publicly available. Why, if it's so accessible, is it so invisible, as I always put it? Why haven't people paid more attention to this? Why haven't they responded to this? I think this is an important question about the level of political consciousness, and I would like to further investigate this. One quick thing I would add to that, in that one day I hope to pursue this. I've already written, as I say, on 1958 on U.S. intervention in Lebanon, but I'm interested in extending my study of 48 to 1952 and the U.S. perception of the first Arab Spring around the emergence of Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt.
Right. Well, that sounds fantastic. Thanks very much for being with us on the show today, Irene. We've been talking to Irene Al-Genzia, who is Professor Emerita at the Department of Political Science at Boston University. She talked to us about her new book, Dying to Forget, Oil Power Palestine and the Foundations of U.S. Policy in the Middle East, which was published in 2015 by Columbia University Press. So thanks very much again, Ari.
Thank you so much, Max. I look forward to being in touch with you.